inch and row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rains come and tumble them down.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a production of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. The podcast of Digging In with Master Gardeners is available through this station and via a link on our own website at ccecolumbiagreene.org/gardening.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. This program is broadcast by courtesy of WGXC Radio 90.7 FM. I'm Teresa Golden, and with me is Jean Thomas. We are two of the Master Gardener volunteers who help to educate county residents on a variety of community horticultural topics. Thank you for joining us today. The topic for this segment is Why We Start Plants from Seed. And with us are fellow Master Gardener volunteers, Marianne Iacino and Joanne Conkra. Welcome, Marianne and Joanne.
Hello. Good morning.
All right. We have to acknowledge that Marianne and Joanne are siblings. Could you tell us about yourselves and especially about how we were lucky enough to acquire you both as members?
I'm Joanne, and I'm from Columbia County. I've been a Master Gardener since 2005. My father was a farmer. We had a big farm here right along the Hudson River, and I guess you can say I've been digging in the dirt since I've been little. So I'm a very dirty little kid. I enjoy what I do, and I get great pleasure out of growing things and giving them away to friends and family.
I'm Marianne, and I became a Master Gardener back in the 90s when I lived in Dutchess County. I relocated into Columbia County about 15 years ago, and I encouraged Joanne to become a Master Gardener, and so we landed in Columbia Green Cooperative Extension Master Gardeners.
Okay, that's a treat for us. Let's dig into the topic for today, seed starting. I know you've both done presentations for Cooperative Extension, teaching people how to start seeds at home. Question number one for most people who have never started seeds, other than the ones and you did the marigolds in grade school, why?
If you start your seeds from home, you give your plants a start and you get a greater harvest. Not only that, but you can save a lot of money. There's packets of the seeds are inexpensive compared to a 4-cell or a 6-cell, and you can plant exactly how many seeds you want and get the plants you want. You got a good variety, and the quantity of plants will be good. You get good satisfaction out of growing your own seeds and seeing your plants grow and harvesting your fruits and vegetables. Also, you avoid getting any chemicals into your plant seeds.
Okay, is that the neonicotinoid thing where everybody gets all crazed because the growers have put poisons into the seedlings that we're putting into the ground?
Yes, more and more, and now we want to go more organic than ever before.
Okay, and if you're like me, you want to show off to the neighbors and grow something that nobody else knows what it is?
Exactly, and you want to be okay. You want to be the first one, too, to have that tomato by the 4th of July.
Mm. Okay, Marianne?
Well, there are some varieties I just can't find in the big box stores. There are certain zinnia varieties that I have to start from seeds, and I have some favorite grape tomato varieties and some cutting varieties that I really like and can't buy in the store, so I start them from seed.
Now, another question comes to mind. Some of our listeners are real beginners. How did they decide which seeds they need?
Well, you buy the seeds that you, and for plants that your family likes to eat. If your family doesn't like to eat kale, then you don't plant kale. But if you like zucchini, squash, tomatoes, cucumbers, melons, those are the seeds you look for, and those are the plants you plant.
And should everybody do what I do, try something they never heard of, at least every season, one thing?
Sometimes every season, something unique comes out, a different kind of squash or a gourd or a funky colored tomato, which is fun to see, to grow, and see what it tastes like and give to someone.
Okay, and they should know some base materials about where they're putting those seeds, right? Like what kind of light and water?
Yes.
Soil, how big the mature plants are?
We're going to talk about all that later, about light and soil and how to plant your seeds and different things that you're going to need so you can get started.
So where do we get seeds and how do we know if they're going to succeed in our area?
Well, you can buy seeds at any of the big stores. You can order from catalogs, seed catalogs. There are very good catalogs out there which give you a lot of information on the seed, what it looks like, what it tastes like, how long it takes to grow, also on the packets. So there's a lot of good places, and you can always call Cornell and ask the masters for any kind of tips that you might want.
Oh, you have classes too, right? There are seed starting classes, and I think you even have a class on how to read a seed catalog, right?
That's talked about in our class, yes. Mm-hmm.
And what about a log?
That's a good idea, to keep a log of what you, well, if you haven't done it last year, it would be a good idea to start it this year. A log of what you planted, where you planted it, what the seeds were, what the plants were, if you had any diseases, how the crop was, and also you can keep a little note about the weather. The weather is a good thing to watch out too for your garden. If the weather's not good, if it's too cold, if it's too windy, if it's too rainy, things are going to not grow well.
What about plant hardiness zones? Shouldn't our listeners understand where they live and therefore what the dates are that they'll expect to last frost?
Yes, that's called our zone. Now, here in Columbia County, we're a zone 5. Up a little bit higher on the mountain, you might have a little bit of time trying to start a little bit later. Your time might be a little bit shorter, too, for your gardening.
And if you're right on the Hudson, it actually could be a zone 6.
Mm. Yes.
And zones would be really important if you're starting perennials. If you're starting annual things, we'll have a single growing season, you're pretty good. But if you're trying to grow a perennial that is zone 7, then you're going to have trouble.
How long have you kept logs, Marianne?
Not very long, not long enough.
Joanne?
Well, I'll tell you that I keep a log and trying to keep the seeds that I planted from year to year and make little notes on how they grew. That's how I thin out what I want and what I don't want.
Okay. I worked for a farmer once. It was a truck farmer. They were a Century Farm. And he had logs going back of every crop, all the weathers, what the prices were, in these little notebooks. He had a box full of them, and it was phenomenal.
What an education. Mm.
And now with cell phones, you probably could take a photograph of the plants and have a real good visual reminder of what worked well and what didn't.
Yeah, that's a lot of tools now that we have.
So let's assume we've gone through the selection process. All of our seed packs are sitting on the bench. What should we have ready to begin the magic?
Well, you need containers. You can either buy containers or you can look around the house to see what you have. If you look around the house, you're going to be amazed at the things that you see that you can use for a container. It could be a half gallon. It could be an egg carton. It could be a muffin container. All these things are good. Don't throw them away. And if you're using something that you haven't used before, always sterilize. 1 part bleach, 10 parts water. You need your seeds. You need soilless mix. Soilless mix is a thing called ProMix, not regular potting soil. Potting soil is too heavy. The seed won't sprout. You need markers. You have to remember what you put in the container. And so you need markers. And if you don't have anything else, you need some plastic wrap, some bags, something that will trap the warmth and the humidity. You need water to start your seeds and keep your ground moist. And you need light. You need some kind of light, either fluorescent light or high density light.
And let's talk about the water. Rookies, like I was once, you can really ruin nice furniture if you don't think ahead about water. Because when you put the water into the soil, it has to come back out somewhere. Mm-hmm. So always plan ahead with trays or some kind of carriers to keep the water.
Also, another thing to remember is that your container with your plants and soil in that you're going to pour your water in needs to have some kind of drain holes because you don't want to swallow up your plants and drown them in the water.
So what should we do first?
Well, first you need to prepare your soil. Get your containers ready. Get your soil wet. Get your seeds ready. Follow the instructions that it requires. You need to water your seeds. Cover the seeds. And provide humidity so that they sprout. Be careful that they don't mold because of too much moisture. You need to provide proper light for your soil and keep an eye on them. Usually in about 7 days, you're going to see some little things popping out of the ground. And when you do that, when you do see that, it's going to be time to take off the plastic or the cover.
So you should designate an area beforehand in case, instead of just picking up a pack of seed and saying, oh, goody, I'm going to start these and putting them on a windowsill, and then thinking later once they're trying to climb out the window that it might be a good time to have planted.
Right, exactly. Because just because they're by the window where there's light doesn't mean that they're going to sprout and grow nicely. If you just do that, you're going to see that they're going to lean and be a little bit on the crooked side because they're reaching for the light. So that's where your good artificial light comes in handy.
And if you read the seed catalog or the seed packet, some seeds can be directly sown into the garden and you don't have to start them indoors. So you need to know that. And then you also have to think that your seeds are going to take up space. And if you have in your plan 30 different kinds of plants to start, you're going to need a lot of space because they're also going to need to be repotted, and we'll get to that a little bit later.
When you get them repotted and grow, you're going to be amazed at how many seeds and how many trays of seeds that you're going to have. You're going to need to have another room.
How come we're always surprised by that?
Well, we're surprised and secretly delighted that you didn't kill them.
It's a guilty secret. Okay.
Also, with your light, your light should be around 4 inches above the seedlings once they come out of the ground. So you have to think of a way to raise the light higher as the plants get taller.
Okay, so that's part of the preparation.
Right,
so
right.
You should
plan
think
ahead.
This out ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So moving your seeds to proper light, they need to have 12 to 16 hours of daylight. Artificial light and winter sun are not as intense as the full summer sun. The natural light from a window is seldom good enough. It's not strong enough for the seedlings to grow. Plants stretch and lean toward the light, and they won't have sturdy stems.
And there's no coming back from that. When they get all stretched out and attenuated, you can't make them go straight, and you just wasted your effort to get them to sprout.
Fluorescent lights are the easiest way to control growing conditions and growing healthy plants. Incandescent light bulbs also give up more heat and less light, mostly red, than the fluorescent tubes, which will produce good transplants by themselves.
And you don't have to go for the big expensive setups. Then you go into the hardware store and they've got this whole big $900 thing where you've got all the perfect lights and the perfect everything. You go get a 4-foot shop light and a plain fluorescent light, and you can get a fancy, what is it, all spectrum light bulb. And you can rig up your own stand with PVC pipe or anything, or stack them on bricks. That's been known to happen, too. So you do not need to buy the big, fancy, elaborate anything. All you have to do is make sure you've got something that gives the light the plant needs at the spacing it needs so that you can move that light up and down, and it does not have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be in a really well-heated room, either, I've found.
I found that with a little, I purchased one of the heating pads for the seed starting trays. It wasn't very much money, and what a difference that made. The optimum temperature is like 70, 72 degrees to get summer plants to sprout. And if you try to keep your room that warm, your significant other is going to say, it's a little bit hot in here. So you're already trying to get the seeds warm. So a heating mat is an excellent thing to splurge and maybe buy.
Marianne spoke about the inches that the lighting has to be from your plants. Plant light should never be more than 4 inches above the seeds or the plants. It will not harm the plants if the fluorescent light touches the plant, so you don't have to worry about that. The best way to ensure that you're getting a good light is to put yourself up with a timer, an automatic timer, to set that, and you'll have it exactly where you want it.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about light. What about water? How much do you water? How often? And how do you know that they're getting enough water?
Well, watering shouldn't be done. You can also touch the soil with your finger. If it's moist enough, leave it alone. If it feels dry and powdery, then you know you need to put more water. Another thing to remember is don't water directly on the seedling or on the plant because you're liable to drown it and it won't grow too much. So it doesn't really need a lot of water. And also check the bottom container of where your pack is. If that's got water in it, be careful because that'll start to get mold and you'll have a problem. You might lose all your plants.
Right, if you have a plastic cover or saran wrap over your seedling pack, you'll see condensation. You don't want that to get too much because it'll induce mold to grow.
When you see the condensation, then you know you've got enough water in there.
Then you have like a little tiny ecosystem.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the water will just keep recycling itself. Okay, we got the seeds tucked in their little cells. Now they're starting to sprout.
Well, once you see the first set of true leaves, that's the first set of leaves that come from out of the plant, you check the plant. Okay, now you can only plant one seed in a cell at a time. Okay, if you fail to transplant, you're going to have crowding and your plants won't develop properly. Usually when you see a second set, that's time to transplant. And how do you transplant? Well, you lift the seedling up by the root ball. Use a spoon or something to support it. Never pull it up by its stem. You can crush it, harm it, bend it, and then it won't grow. If you feel the need to steady the plant, use a little piece of toothpick or a little something to hold it up. A seedling that has not lost a leaf can grow another one, but a seedling that has lost its point can't survive.
Okay, and so they're babies.
So they're babies.
Like babies. Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Handle with care.
Okay. All right, let's assume everybody has success and there's all these little tiny armies of baby plants. They're going to get bigger. So you've transplanted them once, and they've got to be a pretty decent size. Now, all of a sudden, you realize that the little tiny packets you have them in are too small.
So now what do you do? Well, now you pot them up. Potting up is putting these little seedlings into larger pots. You can use a pot, you can use styrofoam, plastic cups, anything, but make sure you put a hole on the bottom. And also continue to use your soilless potting mix.
And you should remember at this stage, now you've got a root ball. A little spoonie might not be enough to transfer that root ball, so you have to be...
You have to be very careful that you don't ruin the roots.
Okay, so if it's already in a tiny container, you can slide it out.
And put it in...
The whole root ball.
Put it in another one, right.
Okay.
That's something you should think about when you're starting your plant. How big is it going to be? And think ahead, how many times am I going to have to pot it up? That can really be cumbersome if you're trying to do this indoors in a certain amount of space. That's when the information on the seed packet and seed catalog can help you.
And another thing, if you started your seeds too early, they're going to grow too fast, and you won't be able to do much with them when they're so big.
Is that when you have the tomato plants that are about 6 feet tall and weigh about, they kind of look more like they should be beans?
That's true.
Okay. Everything's successful so far, it's time to plant. You just take them out and plunk them in the ground, right?
Oh, no. Now you have to harden your plants off. And what does that mean? By the time you want to move your plants into the garden, you should have nice, stocky, healthy plants with several leaves on them. You'll need about 1 or 2 weeks to gradually introduce them to the new growing conditions. That means outside sunlight. This is called hardening your plants off. Move your plants outside in a shady spot, no wind, not a windy day. Give them enough time and enough sunlight to let them harden off. Bring them in at night, cover them up, and you don't want them to get in a temperature of lower than 50 degrees because then it won't work well. After the danger of frost has passed, usually around May the 12th, May the 15th, then it's time to plant them outside where you'll be safe. Don't think you're going to be smart and plant them out the 1st of March because the weather is nice. You may get a surprise and have a cold night and everything is ruined. You can always cover them up with row covers or plastics or bushels or anything, but it's not acceptable to start with a risk.
You're not going to gain anything. You'll set them back. You've spent all this time and energy to get them to be the size they are, and all they need is to be shocked into you stunt them.
And remember that your seedlings are fragile. Okay, and you don't want to, you've worked hard at getting them to grow to where they are now. You don't want to get them ruined.
When the weather starts to get nice, we're always very eager, and I'm one of them. I want to get them out. It's a nice day, and all you need in May especially, is to have a cold, rainy week, and the temperature drops into the 50s, and you've just undone everything you did. So you have to be patient.
And some plants you have to wait even longer, correct? Something like tomatoes. I always hear it's Memorial Day before you put them out.
Memorial Day weekend is a good time to put things out because it's warm enough and you're going to come into those first weeks of June. So that's usually when I plant everything to be nice and safe.
And that's in zone 5.
Yes, that's correct.
Mountaineers know better.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about setting the plants out too early. Sometimes you can set them out too early and the weather's okay and cooperates. But it's been my experience that those little guys just sort of sit there and wait until it's time to go, and they catch right up at the same time as the ones that you put in later anyway.
Right. And to that point, I usually put cucumber seeds directly into the garden. And with the mulch I use, they produce fruit as soon as, if not a little earlier, than things that I might have started in cells inside. So they do catch up.
And that's a case where soil temperature mm-hmm. is important.
Absolutely.
So I've heard there's certain ways to test the soil temperature to make sure it's okay to plant the seeds.
Yes, you can buy a thermometer that goes into the soil to test the temperature. Also, it's a good thing to remember, when the temperature has reached 55 degrees, that's the ground temperature, for at least a week, then you know your ground soil is warm. You can begin to start your plants.
So one last question before we go rushing off to the seed catalogs. What do you ladies do with the leftover seed?
Well, I have some leftover seeds, and this is what you can do. You can keep them for years.
Really? Years?
Yes. How do you tell if they're any good? Well, this is an easy way to do it. Take some paper towels and wet it. Not soaking wet, but just damp. Put the napkin and the seeds in a plastic bag. Put it on top of the refrigerator. Give it a few days. Take a peek and see what happened inside. If you get seeds that have sprouted, you know your seeds are still good. You can still use them. You won't get exactly the same quality and variety and quantity, but you'll get some. Sometimes these seeds are good 4 or 5 years. Now listen, I'm not telling you a hoaxy story here, but I received some, they're called Longkeeper tomatoes, in the year 2003. I came across them the other day in my seed box. Wow, I thought, I wonder if they're still good. Lo and behold, I planted put three seeds in the paper towel, and two of them sprouted. Can you believe it? Since 2003.
Well, I've heard about the lotus seeds from the pyramids, mm-hmm. and they're still viable. Mm-hmm. So there's always hope.
Yes.
Another question that often comes up is, how many seedlings do you aim for? So when you get a packet, do you plant the whole packet? Do you plant half of it? What do you recommend?
I usually like to put in a dozen variety of a particular tomato plant, maybe six pepper plants, maybe three or four pumpkin seeds, zucchini seeds, because they're going to produce a lot, especially pumpkins, zucchinis. Those are fun things to do. Those are things I give away. I like to pick them and give them away. So you can pretty much tell how many seeds, and read the packet too to see what the yield is.
Especially with cherry tomatoes.
Oh, yes. And sweet 100s is a good idea. You only need maybe one or two seeds.
And you only ever plant the ones. That's they come back right. The next year anyway.
Yes, they do.
Thank you, Marianne and Joanne. We're so grateful you were able to join us today. We'd also like to thank WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for hosting this program and for the production support that was provided by Pat Esposito, Donna Peterson, Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners.
Inch by inch and row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sow. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come and tumble them down.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. This program is broadcast by courtesy of WGXC Radio 90.7. I'm Teresa Golden, and with me is Jean Thomas. The topic for this segment is sequence of bloom, and with us are Joanne Conkra and Marianne Iacino, fellow Master Gardener volunteers. Welcome, ladies.
Hello.
Hi, welcome. Good morning.
For clarity, let's define, first of all, what we mean by the phrase sequence of bloom.
Okay, sequence of bloom refers to the different time periods that landscaping plants bloom during the course of the growing season. You can expect that crocus will be followed by daffodils, and roses will follow later in June. Plants respond to day length, water, and temperature, and they flower in a regular order. That's basically it.
So it's predictable.
Yeah, roses don't pop in before crocus. They just, it's all day length, water, and temperature. That has to be exactly right for them to do what they do.
It also sounds though it might be very complicated. Is there a set of rules we need to follow to make this happen?
Well, there are some common sense ways about building a sequence of bloom in your garden. The major factor is planning. And this can be done once you've done some homework by taking a look that's already in place in your garden. With a little research into what else you like, and you can begin creating your own paradise that's always in bloom. And we don't have to be shy about stealing ideas. In public gardens, they're happy to share their ideas, and they even label the plants so you can see what they have and duplicate it in your own garden.
Can we assume that we're mostly talking to people with established gardens or yards, or should we coach newcomers to gardening just a little bit?
Well, they found that most gardeners feel like they're beginners, no matter how long they've gardened. So let's just say that the places you want to plant should be prepared for the new plants you're adding. And ideally, this preparation begins in the fall before planting. And bed preparation is as important as your plant selection. You have to read the tag on the plant. If it says full sun, it means the plant needs full sun. The pH may be specific, like for azaleas. They require a little bit of a lower pH. You need to adjust that in the fall to give the plant, the soil chemistry, chance to change. And you can't have your azalea in the ground and then try to adjust the pH. You're putting the horse before the buggy there. You may need to do that. Does the plant tolerate a dry spot? I found one very, very helpful website, and this is www.gardening.cornell.edu/homegardening. It lists vegetable plants and flowering plants, and it tells you the height, what diseases these plants may be succumb to, color, what time of the year they'll bloom. And if you're not sure, you can call and visit the websites Teresa lists at the breaks. And we're always willing to share what we've learned. Well, we're going to be giving a talk on the sequence of bloom on Spring Gardening Day, and our master gardeners are available to speak at local libraries and garden groups specifically on this topic.
Lots of times when you're out shopping, you see something pretty and say, "Ooh, I'd like to grow that." Really read the label and see if it's, first of all, for the zone, see where it needs to be placed, and take a mental look at your garden to see if you can even grow it anywhere.
So before we dig in deeper, don't we need to also be aware of what we already have going for us? In other words, you know, this should include the shrubs and bulbs as well as perennials that are already in our gardens.
That's right. It's always a good idea to take an inventory of our gardens throughout the year. And it's a pleasant surprise to realize how much we really have working for us. In fact, the existing plantings will give us hints about the environment and what different plants grow happily together. If we think about things like tulips and bleeding heart, tulips with sedum, daffodils and hosta, these are great when they're paired together. And they're even greater when you think about how they grow. Tulips sprout their leaves, put their blooms out, and then we're left with these ugly leaves. As the leaves are reabsorbed, we should leave them on the bulb. If you plant them next to bleeding heart, as they fade out, the bleeding heart will take their place. So you have a nice sequence there. The same thing with tulips and sedum. The tulips leaf out, they bloom, the leaves are left, and the sedum will sort of camouflage them. And daffodils and hosta do the same thing. Those darn daffodil leaves, they're like there till July. Well, the hosta will help camouflage them. So these are great when they're paired together. And of course, knowing the timetable of flowering will help you set up a schedule. Plant selection charts available online outline a timeline of bloom for bulbs, annuals, perennials, and shrubs. And there's also a classic publication by Bob Maurer from Cornell called The Sequence of Bloom of Perennial, Biennials, and Bulbs. And you probably can get that right from our office if you give us a call.
Okay, we're talking about flowering specifically so far, but what about other visual items? I'm thinking of plants whose foliage is their most valuable feature, or that have unusual form or exotic bark. Should we think about those things too?
Oh, absolutely. Interesting foliage and bark often extend the season's visibility. For example, a clump of birch or redwood dogwood can be striking in the winter, or an evergreen shrub can be a nice backdrop for peonies. fall color is an asset too. Successional interest is a broader range of plant characteristics other than just blossoms, which includes foliage, stem color, and texture. This keeps our landscape colorful. So the sequence of bloom is really a little subset of the broader thing called successional interest.
I'm a big fan of annuals. How do you fit them into the sequence of bloom plan?
Well, annuals have a timetable too. There's cool weather annuals like petunias and pansies, and warm weather annuals like cosmos and foreclocks. If you're planting seedlings, their growth and development provides a counterpoint to the slower growth and flowering of your other plants. The major advantage of annuals is that once flowering, most continue to bloom for a much longer time than most perennials, and you can have a nice segue between what's going in and out of bloom.
Annuals can be put into places where your perennials haven't popped up or where you haven't thought about putting something and the ground looks bare. Some nice impatiens or marigolds would look cute in a little spot where there's nothing growing.
Right. And you can prolong their flowering with deadheading, especially marigolds and zinnias. If you don't like deadheading, try plants like impatiens, New Guinea impatiens, wishbone flower, and begonias, for example. And that's kind of important, too. Do you want a garden that you don't have to really tend and keep up with, or maybe you want something a little less labor-intensive?
Okay, so we made a timeline of what blooms in our garden and when it blooms. Now what?
Well, now comes the fun part. Think about what you want to see and do. Do you want a zen look or a riot of color all summer? Are you going to enjoy the garden part of the year? Is it a seasonal home? We have lots of snowbirds here. You may not be interested in an interesting-looking winter garden if you're not even here to enjoy it. Do you like to be in the garden tending your plants, or is your ideal garden mainly maintenance-free? Make a list of what plants you have in a particular season that's already showing off. Like if you look at lilacs in May, just add from a list other things that you'd like to have bloom at the same time. If you're not in a particular hurry, you could visit gardens in your area and see what's in bloom, find new ideas as the season progresses. This is most successful, but pretty slow. And it's a little more complicated because if you want bulbs, they need to be planted in the fall if they're spring flowering bulbs. You need to make a diagram showing height. You want to put your tall plants in the back, shorter plants in the front. And you want to mix annuals with perennials and shrubs. And you want to try to plan for contrast of color and interest.
Well, that sounds pretty daunting. Maybe we should start small and focus on one section at a time, or one season at a time.
Sure, we're not trying to remake the world. The sequence of bloom is just another way to enhance our enjoyment in our gardens.
Okay, one more question. What's your favorite combination of plantings that exemplifies this concept of sequence of bloom?
Well, my favorite season of the year is spring. So if you can visualize snowdrops, creeping phlox, daffodils, crocus, glory of the snow, passflower, Lenten rose, witch hazel, forsythia, which is showy, and then not so much later on, so that's there for the sequence, pussy willows, magnolia, and flowering quince. And spirea and viburnum are our twofer. You get the lovely blooms in the spring, and then they have lovely color interest in the fall. So that's a really, those two would be good to consider.
My favorite is the clematis and the roses. I have beautiful clematis purple in the background and beautiful pink roses in the front, which lasts practically all summer, and it's just gorgeous.
You are listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, with offices in Hudson and Columbia County and Acre and Greene County. You can learn more about the Cooperative Extension by visiting the website at ccecolumbiagreene.org or on Facebook. The topic of this segment is sequence of bloom, and we're joined by Joanne Conquer at Marianne Iacino. Let's dig in deeper. Okay, just for fun, we asked you for some lists. I'll give you a hypothetical garden, and you can give me a hypothetical list of things to plant.
Get your pencils out at home.
A small front garden shaded by neighboring buildings.
Well, I was thinking about this, and I think that you need to have a reference. And there are lots of online references that outline bulbs, annuals, perennials, the whole nine yards. And they give you the season that they bloom, the color that they bloom, lighting requirements, and the whole nine yards. Starting with something like that will help you select plants for a specific spot like this. In a small shaded garden, there are lots of good perennials like Solomon's seal, which is a nice variegated green leaf with little white drop-like flowers that after the flowers fade, the leaves stay there all summer. A lungwort's a nice ground cover with some speckled leaves and purple flowers that give interest after the flowers fade. A lily of the valley, coral bells, which give you a nice height of little blooms above the leaves, and then the leaves will stay there for the rest of the season. Hostas that aren't, they come in so many varieties now, variegated and different colors. They're great. Helleborus. And annuals like coleus add color. And shrubs that would tolerate shade would be something like mountain laurel and holly.
Okay, soil makes a difference there. Some of these are acid requiring, so you kind of have to go sideways to double check on those things as well.
Yeah.
What about a long driveway already lined with lilacs and forsythia with 8 hours of sun every day? What do you suggest there?
Well, things like crocus and daffodils at the beginning of the season, bee balm and dahlias and lilies that will take you through the summer, catmint, and then rhododendron and azaleas that would flower in the spring and remain there, as the background for the end of, for the rest of the season.
So that takes care of Teresa's mile-long driveway to her house.
And I was also thinking that you might have to think about water supply here and how hot does your driveway get if it's blacktopped. You might have to consider some drought-resistant things like creeping phlox, sedum, lavender, artemisia, Russian sage, lamb's ears, coneflower, things like viburnum. And you might have to think about snow removal and where the snow goes if it's pushed out of the way. I have one section of my driveway that's really, really shaded, and I basically just put hosta, different varieties of hosta there. And in the winter, I don't have to worry about the snow. The plants are gone, and we're done plowing by the time they leaf out again.
Timing, sequence. Okay.
What if you have a newly built formal perennial garden in the full sun with only a hedge of boxwood planted so far? How do I fill that out?
Well, you can start with your tulips. Knockout roses would be good. Joanne does a lot with knockout roses and delphinium and tall phlox. Asters and mums would take you right through the end of the season.
I think also you'd have to know about the way the sun is shining on those boxwoods. Where is it located? Which way is the sun coming before you can put in your perennials? They all need full sun.
Okay, let's do an establishment, since we're talking about roses, an established rose garden with shrub roses separated from each other by 3 feet of nothing but mulch. Full sun.
Well, we can go back to our spring bulbs, like tulips. Lupine is nice. Irises, delphiniums, maybe some peonies. Hollyhocks will give you lots of height. Bluebeard, coneflower, and the asters and mums. And I think your selection would probably depend on the color of the roses. You might want to play off in the same color family or go on the opposite side of the color wheel for some contrast. So you really, that would be depending on that.
Okay, Joanne, what's yours look like?
Mine, well, I have some perennial shrubs in the back with some of those roses. I have a few of the coral bells growing there, which the birds just love and the butterflies just love. I have some things that didn't do well. I noticed this winter it didn't do well, and I'm going to have to do some rethinking there. So I'm taking all this in very carefully.
See, we're all newbies, like you said.
You know, you never can say that you know everything. You just know where to find it.
Well, the Thomas Jefferson quote, I am an old man but a young gardener.
There you go.
And that's all of us.
And so many times I've tried things. I really wanted lupine. I really wanted them, and they did not want to grow where I wanted them. So I gave up and planted something else.
That's my hollyhocks. We've all got one. Okay, how gratifying is it to you to do this extra bit of work to extend the color and variety of flowering and coloring? It's a lot of work, but I like the idea of expanding your garden universe by considering time as one of the dimensions, along with the usual length, width, and height. What satisfaction is that giving you?
All this gardening requires a lot of time, a lot of thought, and a lot of effort. Your garden is only going to be as beautiful as the time you put in it. You have to know how to water it, how to deadhead it, how to keep it clean, and you'll amaze yourself at what you can do. Not because you're really smart, but because you care about nature.
And as far as time goes, I don't like to spend a lot of time weeding in a garden. So with a good selection of plants and mulch, hopefully you can spend a lot of time looking at the beauty of the garden, the birds and the butterflies, rather than being enslaved into the maintenance. If it becomes a chore, you're not going to like doing it. So if you have a chance to really enjoy the beauty, it's the end goal.
And landscaping and with mulch is a good idea too, because like Marianne said, you're going to release yourself of a lot of time that you're spent out there in the hot sun sweating away.
Thank you, Joanne and Marianne. We're so grateful you were able to join us today. We'd also like to thank WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for hosting this program and for production support that was provided by Donna Peterson, Devin Connolly, and Pat Esposito. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties.
Inch by inch and row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come and tumble them down.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. My name is Teresa Golden, and with me is Jean Thomas. The topic for this segment is gardening myths. Joining us for this discussion is Joanne Schlenk, a former CCE Master Gardener who used to live in Greene County, but who has recently moved to South Carolina. Joanne, we're so happy to have you in the area again.
Hi there. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start by letting us know a bit about yourself. What prompted your interest in gardening, and how did you get interested in garden myths?
I guess my interest in gardening started as a kid when the lot we lived on was surrounded by trees. I'd dig a hole, plant a flower in any old place. Well, they were good places until my dad got tired of mowing around them. My interest continued, but only in a reading capacity. Life got in the way. Then I retired, took the CCE Master Gardener program, and I was on fire. One day, I found a box of Epsom salts under the sink. I had heard they were good for the garden, so I sprinkled them all over everything. Then I got schooled about what a myth that was and wondered what else was hearsay. I came across Linda Chalker Scott, who has a PhD in horticulture from Oregon State University. And I found her on a Facebook group called The Garden Professors. She's one of a group of academic colleagues who entertain and educate gardeners, not only about myths, but on anything to do with gardening. Dr. Chalker Scott conducts research in applied plant and soil sciences, publishing the results in scientific and university extension fact sheets. So she and her fellow garden professors know what they're talking about. I was hooked.
So let's dig into the specific topic of gardening myths. Gardening life is full of myths and hand-me-down tips. One definition of a myth is false belief. Another is an ancient story. We'd like to use our time with you today to dispel some of the most stubborn myths in folklore while guiding all of us to be more successful gardeners. Perhaps we can start by citing a common belief, and you can let us know if it's a myth or whether there's any bit of truth to it. One that I hear quite a bit is that a perennial garden is less work than an annual planting because the plants come up every year. True? False?
I just want a low-maintenance garden. That's a very common desire of many homeowners. A well-designed perennial garden can provide many years of beauty and enjoyment. They are easier to maintain when they are easily accessible. They are less maintenance than most annual gardens and require less water and have few pests when the native plants are used. Organic mulch helps with weed control and may even add some nutrients and humus to the soil, improving its tilth and moisture-holding capacity. But soil testing is important before you begin buying or planting. The right plant, right place will help you have a more successful perennial garden. However, note that tending a perennial garden can be enjoyable and satisfying work, but it's not low maintenance.
That's true. Just because they come back every year doesn't mean they can change their own diapers, is kind of what it boils down to. Speaking of perennials, here's another true or false. Ants help peonies open their flowers. Is that true or false?
Well, the peony is covered with a protective covering that this myth says the ants must eat away before the flower can break open. The truth is, the bud will open on its own, insects or not. The ants are there only for a shot of sugar. So the ants provide from the peony's nectar, but we don't know if the plant receives any benefit from the ants.
Another thing that you hear very often is the importance of deadheading perennials so they'll bloom again. Is there any truth in that one?
This one is one you can say it depends. Some plants don't require any deadheading. Annuals, in an attempt to make as many seeds as possible, continue to bloom when old blossoms are removed. Perennials can slack off on seed making since they usually come back the following season. That said, some plants will flower again if the old flowers are removed. For an example, Coreopsis, but others do not. That said again, taking off the spent blossoms improves the look of the garden, like daylilies, for instance.
And daylilies, they've been modifying those so much that deadheading actually will turn out beneficial with things like the reblooming Stella Doro. So that's the exception that kind of proves the rule, where you should always deadhead annuals and maybe deadhead perennials, unless it's this exception.
So, yeah.
So it depends really is a good answer on
yeah.
this one.
What about daffodils then?
A daffodil stem needs photosynthesis, producing energy that is returned to the bulb. Many daffodil varieties are actually sterile and don't produce seed. So this is actually one chore that can be crossed off your to-do list. On the other hand, tulips quickly decline if not deadheaded immediately, preventing seed pods to develop. Similarly, the stems of iris blossoms also need to be removed, but keep the leaves so that the rhizomes can recharge for the next year.
So let's switch to another popular myth. Companion plants help plants grow better.
We're giving plants a human emotion when we call them companions. A better name for grouping plants is intercropping, not companion planting. A good example is the three sisters. That would be beans, corn, and squash. Gardeners should group plants according to the growing conditions they prefer, keeping in mind how those plants mature. Example, eggplants would be fine to place among shorter lettuce, as the lettuce would benefit from the shade created by the eggplant, while eggplant and broccoli would not be a good idea, as they grow to similar size and will compete for light and space. So, companion plant charts have entertainment, not scientific value.
So it's companions for architectural and nutritional ideas can work, like with the three sisters that you mentioned. The corn is there as a structural support for the beans climbing up, and the squash make a nice mulch underneath, but they don't each profit from the other ones being there other than mechanically, that they've got a structure to work around. So
right.
They still are kind of companion plants, but they're not something where, oh my goodness, these work so much better together than they would by themselves.
Right.
A common companion combination you hear a lot about is planting basil with your tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not necessarily any real truth to that. Tomatoes don't taste any better with basil or without.
But it's handy to pick up some basil leaves on your way in with your tomato that you just picked.
Very true.
So there's some companionship, but I don't think that's quite what they're talking about.
Probably not.
Okay, let's talk about marigolds. Marigolds in your garden keep the bugs out. True or false?
False. Well, maybe. Tests show no benefit from simple interplanting marigolds with other crops. They do tend to attract beneficial insects, which in turn thrive on the pests. While there might be some suppression of particular nematodes when cover crops of specific marigolds were turned into the soil, no wide-scale deterring of general insects has been seen. But it still looks pretty to combine flowers in a vegetable garden, true?
What about planting tomatoes with eggshells in the hole to prevent black scab on the bottom of the fruit?
The black spots on the bottom of the fruit is what's known as blossom end rot. Basically, it's a lack of calcium moving into the plant with ample water supply. For years, it's been thought that there is a connection between this and calcium, so eggshells, Epsom salt, even Tums have been advised to be added to the tomato patch. These are all a waste of time. Stress is at the heart of blossom end rot, typically caused by uneven watering. Other stresses include excess water, heat or cold, dry soil, or too much fertilizer. Unless you test your soil and it shows a calcium deficiency, eggshells are not necessary. Rather, mulching around tomato plants will help even out the level of moisture.
And I think the amount of time that it would take a tomato plant to access calcium from an eggshell is probably well beyond the lifespan of a tomato plant.
Good point.
Okay, speaking of tomatoes, you got to remove the suckers, right?
A sucker is any new vertical plant growth that arises from the base of a trunk. Suckers don't rob the plants of any vigor, but they do use up nutrients that the host plant could be using. This practice of pruning off suckers, however, does produce fruit that is slightly earlier and larger. Also, it keeps the plants off the ground, which in turn reduces common fungal diseases like early blight, Septoria leaf spot, or anthracnose by increasing the airflow.
Another very common myth that you hear about is woolly caterpillars predict the type of winter we'll have. Any truth?
Probably not. Woolly bear caterpillars range in color from all black to all white, but I've never seen that one. Some with bands, but all with bristly hairs, which serve as protection against predators, especially birds. Folklore has held that the wider the middle brown band, the milder and shorter the coming winter will be. If the middle brown band is narrow and the caterpillar is more black than brown, the winter will be severe. In actuality, the band length has more to do with the caterpillar's age than with weather prediction. As the caterpillar grows, it does through several different stages, molting between each one. Each time it molts, the reddish band becomes larger and the black bands at either ends become smaller. The older it is, the browner it will be.
Large crop of acorns means it's going to be a long, cold winter, right?
No. Oak trees are not clairvoyant. They also don't care about the squirrels, birds, deer, bears, and mice, in addition to other wildlife that eat their nuts, although they do benefit from the fact that some of these critters disperse and bury the acorns. Plants have one mission on this planet. They are all about pushing their own genetics into the future. White oaks produce acorns in 1 year, but the nuts on black and red oaks take a full 2 years to mature. An oak tree has a juvenile period of about 20 years, during which time it doesn't produce any acorns. Many oaks don't make a large crop of nuts until they're around 50 years old. An average 100-year-old oak tree, about 2,200 acorns per season, but only one acorn in 10,000 will become a tree.
The light green moss on the limbs of trees causes the tree to decline. True?
Lichen is a partnership between a fungus and an algae. It's completely harmless to the tree. Rhizines, which are similar to roots, attach but do not go deep enough to harm the tree. Think of them as an air plant, which gets its nutrients from rainfall, dust, and small amounts of decomposing debris, not from the plant from which they are using for support. While many people think lichen causes the tree to decline, it's most likely the lichen was there long before the tree became ill. Lichens tend to only grow in areas that have good air quality, so that's good news.
Got another one. When you're potting plants, you always put a layer of rocks or clay shards in the bottom because it's the drainage, right?
No, putting anything at the bottom of the pot is bad for plants. The hole in the bottom of the pot is there for drainage. Studies have shown gravitational water will not move from a finely textured soil into a coarser soil until the finer soil is saturated. Since the goal is to keep soil from becoming waterlogged, it's ironic that adding rocks or clay shards will cause the very problem it's intended to prevent.
Okay, but you would use them to keep the soil from falling out the hole.
Me, personally, I use a coffee filter.
Okay. Sounds like much more sensible and less weight.
Joanne, it's been a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and expertise. We'd also like to thank WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for hosting this program, as well as production support from Donna Peterson and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can learn more about Cornell Cooperative Extension by checking out our website at ccecolumbiagreene.org. You can contact us by emailing us at colgremg@cornell.edu. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, inch by inch, row by row, let us help your garden grow.
You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties with questions at ccecolumbiagreene.org, visit us in Hudson or in Acre, or ask us questions on the Master Gardeners of CCE Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook group. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal program and employment opportunities. Someone warm them from below.